I'm very happy now to welcome back to the Radio Cafe Stephen Kotler. He's an author and journalist. He lives here in Chimayo, New Mexico. He's co-author with Peter Diamandis of the new book, Bold, How to Go Big, Create Wealth, and Impact the World. Welcome to the Radio Cafe.
Thanks for having me.
So I rarely do business books on this show, as you know, and we had you on years ago when you had written a wonderful book about dog rescue, and now every time you have a new book, we get you back on the air. And it's interesting for me because it's a world which many of us don't acknowledge, namely that technology is changing very, very rapidly and affects all of our lives and is going to affect all of our lives even more in the years and decades to come. You are writing about something called exponential technology. What is that?
So the core idea inside Bold, right, is that for the very first time in history, individuals and small teams can take on grand, global, world-changing challenges. And this has never actually been possible before, right? You go back 1,000 years, you wanted to change the world, you had to be a king and a pharaoh. 100 years ago, it was robber barons, industrialists. Even 20 years ago, you're talking large corporations, big governments. Today, it's all of us. And the first reason it's all of us is because we have access to massively accelerating technology, exponentially accelerating technology. And exponential change refers to a very specific thing, right? It's opposed to linear change. Linear change is linear growth is 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, and so forth. Exponential means it doubles, 2, 4, 8, 16, and so forth. The classic example of exponential growth showing up in technology is Moore's Law. Back in 1965, Gordon Moore comes along and he says, wow, it looks like the number of integrated circuits on a computer chip seems to be doubling every 12 to 18 months. That's crazy. That's exponential growth. I bet it's going to last 10 more years. Lasted 10 more years and 20 more years and 30 more years and 40 more years and 50 more years. It's going on 60 years now, and it functions more like a natural law than a market prediction, meaning it has held steady through wars and famines and market crashes and whatnot. It continues to grow. What is happening now is that Ray Kurzweil, we got a slight detour, Ray Kurzweil, who's the head of artificial intelligence at Google, discovered that once a technology becomes an information technology, meaning you can translate that tech into ones and zeros and program it on a computer, it hops on this exponential growth curve. It starts doubling in periodic time periods.
Now let's talk about an example of that, and there's a very clear and comprehensible example in the first chapter of your book, namely the digital camera.
Perfect example. So Kodak invents the digital camera in 1976, right? A guy named Steve Sisson does it. And he shows it to Kodak, and they go, well, great. It can, you know, it's got like 0.01 megapixels of memory. It's tiny. They think it's a toy. They don't take it seriously. Yet, what's really funny about the fact that they don't take it seriously is they literally created something. A guy named Barry Hendy came up with Hendy's Law. Hendy's Law is the Moore's Law for pixels per dollar, right? And it's an exponential growth curve. It literally was created by a Kodak employee, and they invent the digital camera, but they don't take it seriously. Why? Because when you start doubling, right, if you've got 0.01 megapixels, it doubles to 0.02 megapixels, right? A year later, it still looks like a toy. 0.04, it still looks like a toy. 0.08, it's still one, right? But 16 doubling later, you're at 1 billion megapixels. It gets exponential very, very quickly. They didn't take it seriously, and they ended up going bankrupt. This one technology ended up bankrupting Kodak because their entire business was built on film and paper, which digital pictures made obsolete.
And it's so ironic because they knew Moore's Law, and they had this technology, they invented it, they owned it, and they rejected it because they didn't want to compete with themselves.
It's twofold. They didn't want to compete with themselves, so there's organizational inertia, right? There's like, we do this and we don't want to do that.
We sell paper and film and chemicals.
Exactly. And it's a booming business. Why would we care about this other thing? The other thing is the human brain literally has a very, very difficult time understanding exponential growth, right? Let me put it to you this way. If I take 30 linear steps, right, 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, up to 30 from where we're sitting right now, it's about 2 feet per step, I'm going to end up 60 feet away or kind of on the other side of this cafe. If I take 30 exponential steps, right, 1, 2, 4, 8, I end up 1 billion feet away or orbiting the Earth 26 times. It is very hard to understand kind of the exponential growth that's packed in there. We don't see it. It's very hard to visualize.
And I think one of the reasons it's hard to see and hard to visualize is because, and you describe this in some detail, there's always a really kind of what you might call ugly and awkward stage where you don't think this is going to be great. I mean, that first digital camera and the first generations of digital cameras looked like big boxy toasters and gave crappy images. And so you think, well, this is never going to amount to anything. But if you have the eyes to see.
Yeah, so what we kind of looked at this and we realized that exponential technologies, they grow along a kind of a predictable path, right? They have a predictable life cycle. And we use the term the six D's of progression to talk about this. The first D, digitalization, right? This is when you turn something into ones and zeros and program with it. And the big deal here, why is digitalization such a big deal? It's because culture is always cumulative, right? Culture grows by sharing and spreading ideas. Once something becomes digital, we can share and spread it at the speed of light, right? So it massively amps that up. Usually when this happens, right, new technologies get introduced, there's lots of fanfare, there's big hype. And the second D is deception, because it doesn't live up to the hype. If you're looking at, you know, exponential technology, as you pointed out earlier, when you're doing those initial doublings and you're below one on a curve, it doesn't look like anything, right? 0.01 megapixels to 0.02 megapixels, your digital camera is still a toy. It's a joke. You don't take it seriously. But when it comes out of that deceptive phase, it becomes massively disruptive really, really, really quickly.
So let's talk about a bunch of examples. What are some things besides digital cameras that have gone through this life cycle?
Well, we're seeing it right now. 3D printing is a great example. For 30 years, 3D printing has been around, right? And if you don't know what a 3D printer is, 2D printer is an inkjet printer. It sprays ink on a 2D surface. 3D printer literally adds a third dimension into it. It can spray, it doesn't spray ink, but it sprays plastics or metals or various materials. This technology had been hidden for a really long time, but it is now exploding. It's coming out of that deceptive phase into the disruptive phase. And, you know, we're seeing this all over. Pretty much every car you buy now has a 3D printed part in it. Any jet you fly on, there's 3D printed parts in the engines. Medical devices are extremely far along, right? The classic example being Invisalign braces. Those clear plastic teeth straightening alternatives to the metal braces, every one of those is 3D printed, and they're individually customized, which is what you can do with 3D printing, right? You don't have to make it like a rigid mold. You can change it. So they are printing 17 million pairs of Invisalign braces every year, and they're doing it in a factory, by the way, not much bigger than a college lecture hall, so it's a tiny production facility.
Oh, my goodness.
And it's all being 3D printed. You're seeing surgical tools that are customized to individual bodies. Prosthetic limbs are being 3D printed. This is going on and on. The Chinese just 3D printed 10 single-family homes in a day, each for $2,000. Earlier this year, Jay Rogers, the CEO of a really cool new car company called Local Motors, 3D printed a car in a certain day. What you're seeing is the manufacturing industry is a $10 trillion industry. It's one-sixth of the global economy, and it is entirely going to be disrupted by 3D printing.
And the thing about 3D printing that's amazing is that if you have a manufacturing run of 10 or of 2 or of 1 part, it's cost-effective to do it.
It's cost-effective. Complexity comes for free, which is a really kind of complicated idea. But normally, if you want to, through normal manufacturing, you want to make a really complex shape. You have to build it up one part at a time, and it's very, very expensive. With 3D printing, complexity, really complicated shapes, they just come out of the nozzle that way. To give this an example, you can now, the Toyota Camry dashboard, right, used to have 22 separate parts or something along those lines. It's now 3D printed as a single piece.
We're talking to Stephen Kotler about his book, Bold. So there was this something called the six Ds, and we were talking about digitization, deception,
Disruption. Right.
Now we're on disruption. So
and we're seeing disruption all the way. It's not just 3D printing is causing massive upheavals in manufacturing. Uber is causing massive disruption in the taxi industry. Airbnb is challenging hotels. Very soon, self-driving cars are going to disrupt transportation, delivery, and insurance, and a whole bunch of other stuff, right? This is what happens. The technologies come roaring back out of this trough of deception, and they're everywhere at once. And that's only halfway through the life cycle. And that's when things start to get really radical.
Because, partly, because big companies lose their base.
Well, one thing we are seeing for sure is that, you know, there are companies that are built on the backs of these exponential technologies. As a general rule, they tend to be small and they tend to be nimble and they can adapt. The large companies, right, like Kodak, right, these companies are built literally to resist change. That's how they're designed. But in an environment of massive, rapid change, right, and massive empowerment to the people, right, which is what you get from these technologies, these big companies have a very, very, very difficult time competing. So we're seeing a lot of those companies are starting to get bankrupt, and they're being replaced by these exponential organizations.
What are some examples of those companies besides Kodak that are being challenged?
Well, we're seeing it. I mean, you know, Airbnb has become the largest hotelier in the world.
Is that
right? They don't own a single hotel room because they're leveraging the crowd. Hyatt, 45,000 employees, all this massive infrastructure, it's being disrupted by a company that I think has 140 employees compared to their 45,000 employees.
So economically, that means that these huge companies are in real danger. I suppose in tourist areas abroad, maybe they still...
Well, let me put it this way. Salim Ismail, who is the former head of innovation at Yahoo, and he now is at Singularity University, which is a university that my co-author Peter Diamandis started with Ray Kurzweil to study these technologies, he took a look at what he calls exponential organizations. These are organizations built around all the tools and techniques and things we talk about in Bold. As a general rule, and he found about 50 of them, they are accelerating, they are getting a 10x improvement over their competition. They are 1,000 times more productive than their competition. So, of course, there's no way to keep up. And we're seeing this with Kodak going bankrupt and on and on and on and on. I mean, Craigslist demonetized, advertising in the publishing industry took a hit. You know, it goes on and on with this stuff.
Yeah, I mean, and there's some very serious consequences to society. I mean, Craigslist basically demolished classified advertising, which was central to the health of newspapers. But it's not just about newspapers, it's about democracy, because when you don't have functioning newspapers, you don't have journalism. These things have really great unforeseen consequences.
Massive, massive unforeseen consequences. And a lot of people are very dire about this, right? They see their jobs going away, they see a lot of things threatened, and you know, those things are very, very, very real. But I believe that inside of each of these exponentially accelerated technologies, and there's about a dozen of them right now, there's an internet-sized opportunity just waiting. So we are definitely losing jobs, and it is, you know, it's a scary thing, but it's opening up crazy new possibilities. Imagine, you know, in the early 90s, right, we were in a depression before Clinton's first term. We came into office. We were in a depression. Nobody saw the internet coming. Nobody saw that massive explosion. I think every one of these technologies has that size of a employment explosion hidden inside of it.
So let's go on with the Ds. We've gotten to disruption. What comes next?
We've actually been talking about what comes next. Demonetization is what comes next, right? Technology makes things practically free. So information used to be hugely expensive. Remember the Encyclopedia Britannica? Now you get Google. It's totally free. Digital cameras make film free. Skype made long-distance telephone calls free. Craigslist did the same for advertising. It goes on and on and on, right? So demonetization, the money comes out of the equation. What happens next is even stranger. It's dematerialization. The goods themselves disappear. So if you pick up your standard smartphone, right, inside your standard smartphone, it does the work of a camera, a watch, a GPS receiver, a VCR, a music recorder. This list goes on and on. We kind of calculated in the charts in Bold all the 1980s era technology that now comes free standard in any smartphone is well over $1 million. So on a certain level, yes, our jobs are going away, but we no longer have to spend $1 million on a whole bunch of technology than we get in our smartphone that pretty much anybody can afford at this point, right? So that's dematerialization. The last step in the chain is democratization. This is when the hard goods, the technology itself, becomes virtually free, right? Smartphones, cell phones, they started out these big boxy things. They were for the super elite, and now pretty much every family in America, and pretty soon every family in the world, is going to have one, right? So things become cheaper and cheaper. They get democratized, and it goes super wide.
Now, democratization is, I think, in this context, somewhat paradoxical. I mean, there's a lot of great examples of democratization, like anybody can now make a movie because the software on your Macintosh and a digital camera are crazily inexpensive compared to what they were 10, 20 years ago.
The video editing software you get with the Instagram app for free 10 years ago, it was $2 million.
Right. And you can make, you can produce music, you can do all kinds of things, but at the same time, those professions have gone down the tubes. You can't make money as a photographer anymore, even though the equipment is now crazily inexpensive. You can barely make money as a filmmaker. And so it's like there's a trade-off with that so-called democratization. It's available to everybody, but it's available to everybody to do these things and be poor.
So it's an interesting question, and you it's a lot more nuanced, right? You've presented the very populist view, and you're not wrong, but it's a lot more nuanced. For example, the music industry. There is now more money in the music industry than ever before, right? It itself is booming. It is harder and harder for a lot of individual artists to make a living, but overall, the industry is extremely healthy.
So who's making money?
A lot of people at the top and a lot of new people at the bottom, right? It's a strange system. And your point, though, your larger point is really important. And, you know, I think, in my opinion, and we talked about this earlier, the prophet of this is Jared Lanier, whose book, Who Owns the Future? His argument is information can't be free. Information is free, you basically cut out the middle class. All these things have gone away because information is free. We have to find a way to pay people for it. And I agree with that. We don't talk about it in bold, but I think that's coming. I think that shift is coming. And hopefully it will stop this, you know, horrible decline. And, you know, we talked about this before. I suffered from this too, right? Craigslist took all the money out of advertising. I was a journalist. And, you know, I've had to reinvent my career a good couple times along the way because of this. So I'm not immune to the very forces I'm talking about. I've suffered them too.
We're talking to Stephen Kotler about his book, Bold, How to Go Big, Create Wealth, and Impact the World. I wanted to talk to you also about another one of the D's, dematerialization. There are some things that are never dematerialized, and they're the basics, food, shelter, and clothing. Those are made of material. On some level, they're traded the way they were traded 1,000 years ago, whether it's the farmer's market, marketplace, or the supermarket, or somewhere else where you get your food. You still have to get your food, and it still has to be good for you, and you still eat it.
Well, it's
clothing, same thing.
These are all true, but what we're seeing already is they're being demonetized, right? We're seeing, for example, with 3D printing, shelter is being demonetized. So the Chinese just 3D printed 10 single-family homes in a day. They were smaller homes. They were 750 square feet, but they were still homes. And they did it for $2,000 a home. The next point it may move to is dematerialization. In other words, the actual houses may get so cheap that it becomes, I mean, yes, there's still materials involved and you still have to pay for it and everything else, but the price is going to go practically to zero. Food is interesting because, of course, we're still going to need a lot of food, but we're playing with all kinds of technologically augmented growing technologies now that massively up yields, right? So food is getting cheaper and cheaper as well. And we've seen this, by the way, food has been getting cheaper and cheaper over the past 100 years.
Let's talk about robotics and artificial intelligence. That's a fascinating chapter in your book. What's going on?
Well, the cool thing about this, and this is, so I want to back up for a second, because obviously the core idea in Bold is anybody can do this now, right? That's the big deal, is you don't have to be a technologist to play. And let's talk about robotics. The reason you don't have to be a technologist to play is because these technologies that we're talking about are starting to develop user-friendly interfaces. This is the unlocking move. Think about the web. Web had been around for a long time, 20 years, and it was used primarily by military and scientists because you had to be a computer scientist to play, right? Then Marc Andreessen comes along, and he creates Mosaic, which is the user-friendly interface that becomes the Netscape browser. So before Marc Andreessen does this, there are 26 websites online. He comes up with Mosaic. Within a couple of years, it's 10,000. Within a couple more years, it's over 1 million, right? User-friendly interface unlocks all these technologies. So what's cool, and let's go to robotics. Robotics, a couple of years ago even, right? If Peter and I wrote a previous book to a Bold, which is Abundance, right? Came out in 2012. We were really cautious about robotics. We said, yeah, this is accelerating, but we think it's 15, 20 years away. Why? There were no user-friendly interfaces. Enter Baxter. Baxter was created by Rodney Brooks, the guy who created the Roomba, those little robotic vacuum cleaners.
Right.
Baxter is the first user-friendly, user-safe robot, industrial robot. Baxter is this huge kind of 9-foot wingspan humanoid creature. What's cool about Baxter, there's three things that are really amazing. First is, if you go back 5 years ago and you want to get in a room with an industrial robot, you can't do it, right? We wall them off from people. They were, if you go to Honda and look at their industrial robots on the line, they were walled off behind glass cages because the thing can move its arm, it's going to take off your head. Baxter has a really advanced motion sensor in it, so as soon as it detects anything solid, it stops. So it can't decapitate you, can't hurt you, which is the first time that humans and robots can work together in the same room, right? Other thing that's cool is Baxter, all the technology that goes into Baxter, it's all accelerating exponentially, which means Baxter is $22,000 right now. You go back a few years ago, an industrial robot was millions of dollars. It's $22,000 and the price is dropping radically. In fact, a couple of weeks ago, somebody put out blueprints for a Baxter-style robot that can be 3D printed. So soon we're going to be 3D printing our own things. But here's the cool thing about Baxter. Again, 5 years ago, you want to program a robot, you got to be a computer scientist. Today, you literally move Baxter's arms through the pattern you want Baxter to move. He's programmed. So anybody can have access to this technology, can use it, and can build business models upon it. And we're seeing this. It's not just kind of robotics. AI, classic another example. You said robotics and AI. AI, artificial intelligence. I mean, for years, this technology is totally off limits to anybody, right? IBM creates Watson, this artificial intelligence that wins on Jeopardy. When Watson came off Jeopardy, they sent Watson to medical school. They programmed Watson with all the medical diagnostic technology that you could, or diagnostic information you could possibly want, and then open source Watson on the cloud. So anybody can now access Watson on the cloud for free and build kind of medical device technologies on its back. So access to AI is now available to anybody. Synthetic biology, which is the craziest of the exponential technologies, right? This is a technology that says, hey, wait a minute. DNA can be translated into ones and zeros. You can turn genetic code into computer code, and you can use it to program life, right? This is the power of the gods in the hands of mortals. My friend Andrew Hessel, who's a distinguished researcher at Autodesk, is building what's called a DNA typewriter. It is literally a computer programming device for genetic technology. It's the user-friendly interface for biology. And it's not ready now, but it's coming very, very, very soon. So anybody can play.
Right, including nefarious criminals and evildoers. That's what I think of when I hear about synthetic biology.
And you should. I mean, you know, I wrote a pretty, with Andrew Hessel, actually, and a guy named Mark Goodman, who has a book on the bestseller list now called Future Crimes. We wrote an article for the Atlantic Monthly a couple of years ago saying, hey, wait a minute. One of the things that synthetic biology unlocks, sure, it's new fuels, new foods, new medicines. That's all amazing. It's fantastic. But it also allows anybody to build individual bioweapons.
Exactly.
There's, you know, with great power comes great responsibility. There's no way around it.
Right. Comes great responsibility. But this whole question of responsibility is something that I think about when reading your book. I mean, let's say you invent and help bring down the price of a robot that puts 90% of the service sector employees in the United States out of jobs. Whose responsibility is that? What happens?
Well, so the jobs question is super interesting, and it's worth looking at it historically. This has been going on for a very long time. If you go back to the 1800s, right, 75 to 85% of America were all farmers, right? The manufacturing revolution comes along, and less than 2% of us are farmers. And as that change was going, everybody was totally panicked. Oh, my God, I'm going to lose my job. What are we going to do? And it turns out, no, there's a whole other revolution waiting for us. This story gets repeated over and over and over, right? The same process. New jobs come in. So the question you're really asking is, will those new jobs arrive fast enough to replace the ones we're losing? And the robotics and AI, most people got really worried about this a couple years ago because scientists at Oxford and researchers at Oxford looked at America and they said, wow, 45% of all the jobs in America, service jobs, can be lost over the next 20 years to automation. That's AI and robotics. This is absolutely true. Now, what are those jobs? Well, it's your checkout counter cashier, it's your shelf, it's your, you know, stockers at Walmart and things like this. the first question you got to say is, does anybody really want to do those jobs? Because they're not deeply fulfilling jobs, right? So on a certain level, as long as there are new jobs for the people, we're not losing anything we really want to hold on to. The question is, are those new jobs coming along? And, you know, I said earlier that I think there's an internet-sized opportunity hidden inside of all these exponential technologies. And I think that's true. I'll give you a really simple example. Virtual reality. Virtual reality is progressing exponentially. Over the next 3 to 5 years, it's going to become a real market. It's moving out of deception and into disruption. We already know, because we learned back in the 90s, in 1996, the first millionaire in Second Life was created. Second Life is a virtual world, right? Created by Philip Rosedale. It's neat, and you can make money in there. So we've already seen that there's whole economies sitting inside of it. They just haven't opened up yet. And we know that virtual reality technology is moving exponentially. And we also know that for a variety of reasons that are way too complicated to go into, we're going to be able to produce very quickly virtual experiences that are more fun and arguably as meaningful as real-world experiences. We're hedonistic people. We're going to go where the fun is. We're going to go where the meaning is anyways. We're going to start migrating into virtual reality much in the same way that we migrated into video game reality in the past 20 years, right?
Right, and made all of our children dopamine addicts in the process.
Well, you say that like that's a bad thing. There's a tremendous amount of data that shows people, kids who play video games on a regular basis do better in school. They actually get more exercise than kids who don't play video games. A lot of the things that people kind of tot around about video game addiction, they're actually not true when you look under the hood of this stuff. So, you know, yes, they absolutely made all of our kids video game addicts, for sure. But it's, you know, we were television addicts before that, and it seems like video games actually give us a whole lot more than television did. It's a little more interactive, and I think virtual reality is going to give us even more.
We're talking to Stephen Kotler about his book, Bold, How to Go Big, Create Wealth, and Impact the World. One of the things that I think is really important to talk about, which goes along with the whole democratization, and I kind of think of the Marxist concept of putting the means of production in the hands of ordinary people, and part of the means of production is funding and capital and things like that, and there's so much that's going on right now in terms of both crowdfunding, crowdsourcing, and I was wondering if you could talk about that a little bit.
Yeah, so, you know, clearly exponential technology gives people tons of power, right? Access to tons of power, but it doesn't, like, you can have the hands of God, or the power of God in the hands of mortals, but you still got all the kind of mortal challenges of how do I raise enough money? I need access to expertise. The rate of innovation is incredible right now in the world. You need to keep up with the rate of innovation over and over and over again. This is where a whole second suite of tools are coming online. We call them crowd-powered tools. These are things like crowdfunding, crowdsourcing, incentive competitions, and DIY communities. They literally leverage the billions and billions of people who are online today and the billions and billions of people who are coming online in the near future.
DIY communities, do-it-yourself.
Do-it-yourself. Communities, absolutely. And we'll start with crowdfunding because it's the easiest place to start, right? Access to capital is the biggest problem anybody starts. If you want to start a business, you want to get into these kind of world-changing games, where are you going to get the money? Crowdfunding, you know, when it got started back in 2009 with Kickstarter and whatever, it kind of jumped up immediately. It was a $6 million market before the first year was out in 2009, which is a lot of money. Today, it's up to $15 billion. By 2020 or 2025, depending on whose numbers you go with, it's going to get up somewhere between $100 billion and $300 billion. Now, right now, if you want to raise capital, you're a business, you go to a standard kind of venture capitalist, right? The whole venture capitalist pool is about $40 billion. So we're talking about, you know, quadrupling, if not more, the amount of money available to entrepreneurs. And I'll give you like a classic example of what this does, because it's not just about money. So one of the guys we write about in Bold is Eric Migakovsky. He created something called the Pebble Watch. He got out of college. He had this cool idea for a new smartwatch. And he went, okay, this is great. I'll form a little company, and I'll go to Silicon Valley, and I'll try to raise some money. 20-some investors all said, no, this is a bad idea. We're not going to do it. At a last-ditch attempt, he was like, okay, I'm losing my money. I'm going to lose my company. He put the project up on Kickstarter, right? He wanted to raise $100,000. That's what all he was looking to raise. He did raise that $100,000 in 2 hours. Over the course of his first month, it was up on Kickstarter, he raised over $10 million. this is cool for a bunch of different reasons. First of all, it's cool because he got the money. But it's also, he managed to test the market, right? It was product viability before he built anything. He knew there was this, all the venture capitalists said, hey, there's no market for this. We think you're wrong, right? $10 million worth of people, the crowd, got online and said, oh no, we really want this, make this, please, right? So suddenly he had access to promotion and marketing and a whole community of supporters around him and the capital he needed. He did all these things with this one tool. So a lot of these tools serve multiple functions.
When somebody does something like that, okay, they want to make a smartwatch, they can't get the capital, they go online, they raise $10 million, does that automatically guarantee success? Does that mean it's a good idea because all their donors said it was a good idea?
It means he's going to get a shot, right? I mean, because what people are doing, he got that $10 million because people pre-purchased his watch, right? That's what they did. They said, if you build it, you know, here's $100, and when it's built, send it to me. That's essentially what they did, right? It was pre-sale. Crowdfunding is getting much more complicated now, and you can do bigger ideas and other things besides watches and just pre-sale campaigns. But it is a much close, it cuts out the middleman, right? So that's what's cool about it. It's somebody says, I've got this great idea. Let's see if there's an audience for it. Let's see if people want it. We'll take it directly to people. So you're cutting out all the middlemen there, and that's what's interesting.
And so, again, you're going straight to the source for things like capital, which were once the purview of just a few, lucky few who got that capital, just as you can now make a movie when you couldn't before. And it's part of this like democratization movement, which is very interesting. And it's not only capital, but things like graphic design are being crowdsourced.
Yeah, so you're getting into crowdsourcing, which is right the second issue. If you want to do anything right, you need access to expertise. There's no way around it. People don't realize that crowdsourcing has become an extremely mature idea. Crowdsourcing is literally like, hey, I need help from the crowd, and let's see who's out there, right? And what ideas they've got. Well, you can now crowdsource anything. If you want to hire a quantum physicist, you can crowdsource quantum physics. If you want to program an artificial intelligence, you can crowdsource that. Access to expertise is everywhere. And so, you know, once again, you don't have to be a technologist to play, because you can get access to the expertise you need.
And you just basically do that online. And there are some amazing stories of somebody who needed, what was it? I think one of the examples in your book was of somebody who wanted to find somebody to do kind of a basic job, and they just couldn't find anybody locally, and they put it online and suddenly they had 72 applications.
Which is not unusual. That tends to happen, right? Usually before you kind of had a scarcity problem. I can't get the expertise I want. Now you have an abundance problem. Like you put the problem online, you have hundreds of answers, and it's a filtering problem. You have to kind of switch the way you normally do business, but it's a cool new problem to have.
And it's even going into advertising, even TV advertising, video, stuff like that is suddenly being done very cheaply through this same...
Yeah, it's a company called Tongle that decided to do that. They're based in LA, and they realized there was all this incredible talent out there. And if you wanted to make a commercial, usually, right, it costs millions and millions of dollars to make a TV commercial. The development cycle is very slow, and you only get one final product, right? And they found a way to kind of crowdsource TV commercials. It's a multi-stage process, but you get hundreds and hundreds of ideas, and they all kind of sort of get tested out and weeded out. In fact, the video that we made for Bold, the trailer for Bold, we crowdsourced using Tongle.
Exactly.
So we took our own medicine on that one.
And it worked out for you.
It does. It's a very different way of doing business. And the one thing people don't realize about these tools is, for most people, these tools are really, really, really new. And they treat them like they're new things. And, you know, people think about Kickstarter in the way that you do. Oh, I've got this crazy idea for a movie. I'll put it online and we'll make my movie, right? These things have now been around long enough. They've developed into kind of established business practices. There are best practices. One of the things that we did in Bold is, for example, crowdfunding, right? When we looked at crowdfunding, we said, well, we want to tell people how to do this. We, of course, talked to all the people who'd run super successful crowdfunding campaigns, and then we talked to all the people who run crowdfunding companies. We got that expert opinion, And then we looked at, you know, how many articles and papers and online documents. We found 90 different credible reports on how to crowdfund. And what we did is a meta-analysis. And so what's in bold is, and we did this for crowdsourcing and for DIY communities and all the four of these, we did this giant meta-analysis. So you get sort of, as of right now, and I'm sure somebody's going to replace this very soon, it's the most current, up-to-date kind of how-to, this is all the best advice, this is what you do, start to finish, to do these kinds of things, because they are really established, that you have to treat them very, very seriously, and they're not easy. Like, doing a video on Tongo, yeah, we got exactly what we wanted, but it's a very different process, and it's hard, it's a lot of work, it's not, you know, it gives us a lot of leverage, but it doesn't mean it's easy.
We're talking to Stephen Kotler. This book is very much a kind of a handbook for people who want to learn to think entrepreneurially and to use technology in new ways. But it's also very much, I mean, some of the principles in it are very much relevant and useful for anybody running any kind of organization, whether it's a nonprofit or anything else.
Well, I think it's more than that. Yes, you're totally correct, but these changes are coming, right? Like, these accelerating technologies are not getting out of us. The other thing we cover in this book are a whole suite of kind of mental tools, right? Neuroscience, neurobiology is accelerating exponentially. As a result, we are getting all kinds of insight into our mental abilities. And one thing we talk about that is kind of really kind of near and dear to my heart is flow states. And without going into too much detail, these are just states of consciousness where we perform our best and we feel our best. Those moments of total absorption, we get totally sucked into the moment. These massively amplify performance. In studies done by McKinsey, for example, it's a 500% boost in productivity. The reason I'm mentioning these things is it's not just the technology and these crowd power tools or these mental tools. Companies are using them. People are already using these things. So if you think about flow, right, flow is being woven into principles at Amazon, at Google, at Patagonia, at Toyota, a lot of venture capital companies. People are using this stuff. It gives them a 500% boost in productivity. Imagine the leg up on the competition. My point is, if you're not using these things, you're going to go the way of Kodak. You're falling behind this curve, right? If you're starting a business, you need to be starting a business on these principles. If you're becoming an entrepreneur, you need to pay attention to what's going on, because the old way will not work at all.
Tell us a little bit more about these mental states that are so productive and how one cultivates them.
Well, there's a lot of different kind of mental tools that we poke at in the book. Flow is the one that's closest to my heart, obviously, because I run the Flow Genome Project and I study flow.
And we interviewed you about your book on flow.
Rise of Superman, right. Turns out that flow states, we now know, have a bunch of triggers. These are literally preconditions that lead to more flow. There are 18 of them in total, and they're not all that tricky, right? Flow is a present tense experience. It happens when all of our attention is focused in the current moment. So all these so-called flow triggers are literally just hacks to drive your attention into the current moment. And I'll give you a really simple one that we spend a lot of time talking about in bold, which is passion. Passion, people like to fetishize passion. It becomes this big mystical whatever. And that may be fine. It may be all those things. But what's really cool about passion is it's a focusing mechanism. We pay more attention to those things that we believe in, right? And as a result, it drives attention into the now and it precipitates flow. It's a really kind of simple equation there, but it makes a huge difference, because you got to think about it. If you've got a passion-based company and it's producing flow states in the employees, and those employees are 500% more productive in flow than out of flow, and you've got a company that doesn't do that, right? It might be competing, but it doesn't have that access. There's no way to compete.
You write about the difference between missionaries and mercenaries. So you might have two people or two companies, one of which was founded by somebody who cares deeply about the mission of that company, and another one who is in it to make money.
Yeah, that's actually Jeff Bezos's terminology, the CEO of Amazon, but it does tend to be true. There are two different ways to kind of come into business, right? And the missionaries versus the mercenaries. The missionaries are in it for the cause, the mercenaries are in it for the money. And, you know, over and over and over again, you know, people who are in it for the passion end up winning.
Is that really true? I mean, if you look at Mac and PC.
Well, it's interesting because you would never, I mean, whatever else you want to say about, you know, Steve Jobs versus Bill Gates, neither of them lacked passion. They had different ways of going about it, but, you know, Microsoft, on a certain level, was a passion-based company.
So we're talking about all these exponential technologies. They're here. As you said, there's no putting the genie back in the bottle. Life is changing very, very rapidly in ways that pass us by sometimes. We don't even realize how much it's changing until it's happened. And when I look at your description in the book Bold and where it's all going, it seems to me that there's some real winners and losers. I mean, it's a great time for entrepreneurs who are living on the edge and living their dream, and it's a great time for their investors and shareholders, and it's a great time for customers who get all kinds of products, and Amazon prides itself on being customer-centric, and you can get something in 2 days, and if Amazon has its way, you'll be able to get it in a half an hour through unmanned drone. And then there's the downside, which is it's not at all about employees, by and large. I mean, Amazon pays its employees horribly, and they have horrible working conditions, and there's been a great deal written about that. It's certainly not about the environment, which is stressed to the breaking point with all the consumerism that comes from these technologies, which we come to feel that we need, or maybe we really do need them. And I think that when these things happen, they have to go hand in hand with a conversation about the kind of society that we want to live in and how to mitigate the downsides of these changes. The changes appear to be inevitable, but they don't happen without all kinds of consequences, which are just as important as how fast my smartphone is.
So there's two sides to what you just said, right? The first side is you said this is a great time for people who are entrepreneurial, as if that kind of excludes the vast majority of people. Right now in America, 50% of our GDP, right? 50% of the money in our economy is small businesses and entrepreneurs. So it's gone from a very thin sliver to a much bigger slice. So you're talking about half of America at this point. It's not some small pocket of locked-in Silicon Valley, right? It's a lot of people.
Yeah, but most of those people are not the entrepreneurs themselves. They're the people working for them. So if you include Amazon in that, I mean, we're back to square one with these people making $9 an hour.
Well, that's one side of Amazon. There are a whole lot of other people working for Amazon who are making more than $9 an hour. You're talking about people in Amazon's, you know, factories doing the kind of lowest rung job. And yes, as we've been saying kind of all day, these jobs are going away. New jobs, we hope, are coming that are going to fill their place. And do we have to proceed and have this conversation out loud? And yes, absolutely. Of course. It's a tricky conversation, though, because government, which has routinely been kind of the brake, right? It's the thing that says, okay, we're going to kind of protect the people. Government is not designed to move at the speed of exponential technologies. We built America, right? When Jefferson and everybody else came up with this concept that we call America, they saw the French Revolution. They designed a system to not change very, very quickly. They balanced it out with three houses to move slowly. Right, it's phenomenal in a sense for democracy. It's lousy in an exponential world, and we're going to have to revisit a great many of these ideas. Right, our safety nets need to be revisited for sure.
Stephen Kotler, I wanted to ask you, what is the attraction of all of this whole subject for you personally?
It's twofold. So, in all honesty, think back to who you were when you were 16, when you were 17, when you were 18, and how big your dreams were and how much you wanted to change the world. And I think this is coming for a lot of people at that age. And it doesn't happen, right? Life gets in the way. It's just too hard. Today, for the very first time, the technology, the tools, the techniques we need to level up, they're no longer out of reach. They're possible. And I saw this in my own life, right? I've been interested in flow science my entire life. If you go back to 2000 when I started working on it, I remember having a conversation with Dr. Andrew Newberg, who had just done the first kind of SPECT scan, which is early brain imaging, right before fMRI. visualization of flow in the human brain. And I remember talking to Andy, and I was like, do you think we're going to crack this in our whole lifetime? And he said, no, I don't think so. And I had just, you know, this was for West of Jesus, my second book, and I just done all the years of research into the field, and I totally agreed with him. 14 years later, I wrote Rise of Superman, which sort of outlines all the science. So my entire career in flow research is based on these very technologies, right? And obviously, I think they have a world-changing impact. So at a certain level, that was very personal to me. On another level, the question you're asking is, why the hell did you write a business book? And the answer is, I love the challenge. Business books, as a general rule, have two problems. Either they have no good stories, right? They're boring to read, they're poorly written, they're not fun, they're not interesting, or they're not really actionable. For example, Malcolm Gladwell's The Tipping Point is a great business book, right? Big ideas, everything else, but you don't walk away going, oh God, I know how to do this now, right? It's good stories or it's how to. It's not both at once, and I like the challenge. As a creative, as an artist, I went, okay, can you write a riveting business book that has packed with action items on every page? And that was the goal. I took it, you know, besides personal interest in, like, I've watched all these things happen in my own life, I loved the creative challenge of it.
What's next for you?
I have a book coming out in May called Tomorrowland, which is about all of kind of the moments in time that in the past 20 years that science fiction has become science fact, and the kind of massively disruptive impact those changes are having on culture.
So the stuff that we saw on the Jetsons now being...
All of it. I mean, it was really, it's really interesting. I made a list back in the early 90s of all the kind of the top science fiction technologies. And for 20 years, that was my beat as a journalist. I was in the room when a lot of these things kind of went from science fiction to science fact. And the crazy part is when I kind of put all this stuff together to write this book is there's not all that much stuff left on the sci-fi list anymore. It's really insane.
Amazing. Stephen Kotler is a journalist. He's co-author with Peter Diamandis of the new book, Bold, How to Go Big, Create Wealth, and Impact the World. Thank you so much for being with us on the Radio Cafe.
Thank you, Mary Charlotte.